Yes, I remember everything. I know who I am. I am the Doctor. I am the Doctor.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's had so many changes of possible episodes this week that you could potentially have had three to choose from. We're carrying on our trip through those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Rebecca Chapman.
And I'm Kenny Smith. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, and I'm going to try and do this all in one breath. Whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audio, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else we can lay our eyes, ears, hands, and, as always, grubby little protuberances upon. Hello, Becca.
Hello. Definitely not our tongues after.
No, the recent debacle, but it did make Tina Peters laugh, one of our favourite listeners, so that's always a good sign.
Yes, that was always fun. Well, today we are joined by a friend of ours, and I don't just mean Merlin the cat. I'm talking about Merlin's pet, the one and only Martin Montagu.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Yep, we're here to discuss the second series of BBC Seven's Beyond the Vortex. So hello, Martin, from me, and hello, Merlin. Oh, no, he's not there, is he? You better tell us where he is.
He's out venturing in the field. He was last seen stalking something. I don't know what, but he may be bringing me a present back. So if you hear this sort of ungodly squeal, that'll be me trying to deal with something that's not quite dead.
Yeah, some kind of mouse or the likes.
Yeah. Well, he keeps trying to catch the cows in the field, and I keep telling him he hasn't got a cat and owl's chance, but he's very determined. So who knows?
Does he round them up?
He tries to ride them, actually. It's the same with the sheep, and they don't like it. And there's this bull in the field as well, who's enormous. And I'm setting Merlin down and saying, look, big bull. Our fence is a bit flimsy. Merlin's going, I'm a cat. Can't understand a word you're saying. And then he goes off and does it anyway. So there we go.
Of course, while we have you, we have to ask you about Merlin's Saturday cat day videos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's become a bit of a thing. I don't know quite how we discovered it, but Merlin goes nuts for egg yolk, freshly cooked egg yolk. And it's got to be runny egg yolk. He won't touch it if it's solid. And he won't touch egg white. And I think it came out because there was one day I was having my Saturday brunch. And he was interested because it was something that I was eating, but he wasn't. And I was like, it's a bloody poached egg. He won't like it. And they go, oh, I might do. And so I let him try some. And that was it. It was like I just fed him crack cane. You know, he was just going nuts for it. And so eventually, I thought that I found the only way to get him off my back and let me have my breakfast in peace, and I do mean get him off my back, literally, he was on my back, on my shoulders, was just to give him a spoonful of his own egg yolk in a little saucer, which he would wolf down, and then he would clear off. And I think some friends of mine were going, seriously? And I was going, yeah. And they're going, you know, there's all a video where it doesn't happen. So I posted the video on Twitter, and then, you know, posted a couple. And then there was a few Saturdays I didn't bother, and I was getting all concerned, messages from people going, hasn't Merlin had his yolk? You know, we don't leave the house until we know he's had his egg yolk. I was like, oh, blimey, okay. So yeah, it became a bit of a regular thing then. Sorry, that was quite a long answer, wasn't it? Sorry.
No, not at all, it was great.
Okay. Becca, does your Merlin like egg yolks?
I don't think he's ever tried an egg.
Well, it's a funny thing, Madge, our other cat, won't go anywhere near it. She's not interested at all. And Merlin also really goes for cat milk. Really, he goes insane for cat milk. And again, Madge won't. She's like, yeah, what's that? Give me some chicken. And that's it. That's all she's interested in.
My Nemo's never been particularly bothered by eggs. He sort of just looks at them and just goes, nah. And then he wanders off. So we should point out, for listeners who may have missed it, you both have cats called Merlin, which we discovered previously.
Yes. Yeah, because the first podcast I did, Rebecca was in the background there complaining about Merlin. I was thinking, he's not even in the room, because I hadn't realised at that stage we both got cats called Merlin. Well, I was thinking, what's he doing? Has he transported over? We should do a Two Merlins podcast.
We should.
Battle of the Merlins.
Just make sure you keep this on Taran's out of it in case they're trying to do something evil to them.
Yes, exactly.
The cat salon and premature or something. Oh, no, we're not going there.
I know Madden's got into this strange routine at the moment where I wake up in the morning with my partner and then I do my partner's lunch while he's getting ready to go out to work. And at the moment, all he's having is ham sandwiches. And every time I open the fridge, as soon as my partner's gone off to get dressed and I open the fridge, Merlin's there going, meow, meow, meow. And we'll not stop until you give him a piece of ham.
Ours is exactly the same. Open the fridge. Oh, that might be for me. It's not for you. Oh, for heaven's sake. You have some. Yeah.
It is now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm really enjoying this week's episode of Pieces of Merlin. I suppose we should move on and do a little bit of talk about for the real reason why listeners are here. Well, we'll keep it for the Cat podcast another week. Yeah. But for those of you who missed our previous episode, and we recommend you do go back a few weeks and find our first episode on Beyond the Vertex. Becca, can you tell us what the incredible website tardis.fandom.com has to say about the series, please, and get that narrating voice ready?
You know, sometimes when I do the narrating voice, I can almost hear the resemblance to the woman who plays Charlie Pollard.
India Fisher.
Thank you. Almost hear the resemblance. Almost. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Beyond the Vortex was a 2007 series of audio documentaries broadcast on BBC 7. They followed the BBC radio broadcast of the first and second series of audio adventures of the Eighth Doctor and Lucy Miller. The behind-the-scenes programme was essentially the audio equivalent of Doctor Who Confidential, the show which accompanied BBC Wales' televised episodes. A standard episode of the Eighth Doctor / Lucy adventures did not completely fill an hour-long programming block. Vortex thus filled in the remaining few minutes of the hour. Because the related stories did not have a standard runtime and the impetus for Vortex was to offer a complete hour to BBC 7, Beyond the Vortex ran between 5 and 9 minutes. Each episode of the first series was accompanied by its own episode of Vortex, but BBC 7 only requested 6 episodes for the second series, which they broadcast between 19th of October and the 23rd of November 2008. As a BBC 7 production and not a Big Finish Productions one, Vortex did not appear on Big Finish Productions CD releases of the various stories from the new Eighth Doctor Adventures range. However, the Big Finish made behind-the-scenes interviews that appeared on the CD releases typically covered the same beats as Beyond the Vortex and were much longer. The series was mainly produced by Martin Montagu, the BBC 7 producer who originally commissioned the new Eighth Doctor Adventures for BBC 7.
Are you happy with that, Martin? Anything you want to quibble with or take issue with, or is it genuinely accurate for once?
Yeah, it's kind of spot on. I didn't actually commission it. It was our head of programmes commissioned it. I'm trying to think what my actual specific involvement was. I'm trying to think that there was some kind of weird title I think I was given at that stage, a polite one, not a rude one. But yeah, that's essentially it. Yeah, it was essentially the Beyond the Vortex is... Vortexes were like kind of polyfiller, if you like, to fill up the hour block, because we had to try and get stuff to start on an hour, on the hour or half hour, you know, where we could.
A few weeks ago, you told Kenny about how Beyond the Vortex came into being.
Yes.
At what point did the second series get commissioned? And did you feel like you'd learned anything from the first series that you could take into the second one?
Not a thing. No, I didn't take anything away from it at all. No, trying to think really. It was a funny time because it was BBC 7 had been, this is another one of my really roundabout answers. BBC 7 had only been on the air a few years and there was always so much to do and gaps to fill. And so I think an awful lot of stuff was done on instinct. And so essentially the second series of Beyond the Vortex was commissioned as soon as we knew that we were going to be getting the second run of the Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith stories, those six. And then work, I don't think, really started in earnest until we knew the exact running time. And actually, the other thing I forgot to mention, actually, last time I spoke to you, Kenny, was how it all came about, the behind-the-scenes stuff. One of the things we were actually very keen to do to make it different to the extras you got on the CDs was the Beyond the Vortex would be purely the production side of it. So it was all people like, gosh, I can't even remember now. I mean, obviously there was the Nick Barnaby, Jason. I'm trying to think who else I spoke to for it. But it was all that sort of thing. So it was more production rather than talent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Does that answer the question? I can't remember.
Yes, yes, it does.
Excellent.
So what were your highlights from this run and any particular memories? Because I think you mentioned last time you were in studio on your birthday for one occasion.
I was. Yeah, yeah. Hold the line, caller. I'm just checking up the exact date of the recording. It was for the... ironically, it was for the two episodes that we didn't actually buy in. But that was the day I was in studio to get some of the behind-the-scenes interviews. So it was the Sisters of the Flame and The Vengeance of Morbius. And that was nice because I got to have a great chat with good old Sam. And I hadn't realised at that stage what a big Doctor Who fan he was.
Samuel West, talking here.
Sorry, Samuel West. Yeah. You get an awful lot of actors who it is their job. They turn up, they act. They're not necessarily really invested in the history of Doctor Who. But Samuel West really was. And I can't remember, there's something I said to him. The first thing I said was, you know, of course, this is your first foray into Doctor Who. I'd forgotten Dimensions in Time. I'd forgotten he was Rani's assistant in that completely. So I got corrected over that. And I was like, okay, sorry, I got that wrong. But there we go. We had a nice long chat, and you know, he was talking about, you know, he got such clear memories of the original Morbius story, Brain of Morbius, and it was great. And then Alexander Siddig was there as well, playing. Was he playing a millipede or something? I can't remember what he was.
A trail.
Oh, that's what he was. Yeah, he was a kind of a policeman millipede, and I thought, okay, that's something to put in your CV, isn't it? And he, you know, he was an absolute delight. In fact, they all were. And it was such a fabulous recording session as well, because Nicholas Grace was in Straxus, so he was just holding court. Lots of tales to tell, none of which can be repeated in public, I don't think. No, it was great.
Interesting.
That was my highlight. That was my birthday.
Oh, that sounds like a great treat. Here's a fact for you. Did you know the Scottish actor Brian Cox, the original Hannibal Lecter, was at Longleat in 83 because his son Alan was such a big fan, he was taken along to that? There you go.
You know, I'd actually forgotten Alan Cox was Brian Cox's son. Mm-hmm. Goodness me. I knew Alan Cox had been there, but I hadn't made the connection. Oh, yeah, that's a nice little fact.
There you go.
Yes. So the second series consisted of just the 6 episodes. Could you tell us why?
I think it was a budgetary reason. I think that's what it went down to. Because around the time 2008, BBC 7... I don't think it would become Radio 7 by that stage. That was one of the things I oversaw the name change to Radio 7 shortly before I left, because it would just seem nonsense. We didn't have the word radio in the title and it confused people. So, yeah, the BBC 7 was starting to commission sci-fi of its own. And so the budgets were going kind of here, there and everywhere. And other programmes were being bought in as well. There was kind of around about the time we had... big cast Narnia production that we were putting out. So I think essentially it was just down to cash with a view to maybe buying the last 2 stories in at a later date, which I believe happened sometime after I left.
Simple as that. So there we go. So Martin, looking back on it, how proud are you of the series, knowing that you captured a particular moment in time to show how a series was made?
Well, to be honest with you, Kenny, I'd never really thought of it like that. At the time, it was just a job, you know, filling in a few minutes of airtime. And I mean, obviously, you know, I think I became a Doctor Who fan in the womb because I'm the son of 2, you know, Doctor Who fans. So it's something I've always watched. But it was funny. I think it was only after the event when people said, "Oh, you got to go along and meet these people, you know, all these cast and crew." And I thought, well, yeah, I suppose I did. Yeah, that was great. So, yeah, so, sorry, roundabout way, again, I'm answering your question. Yeah, I suppose I am quite proud of it, really. You know, it was just, it's very nice, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Martin, for that insight. It is always a joy to have you on for a chat.
Cheers. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
We should talk about cats. We should have our own cat podcast.
We should, we should.
The things that I'd still think the 2 Marilyns has got some mileage in it. It can sort of like Marilyn's week, what have they been up to, and
yes,
their
exactly,
adventures.
Yeah.
And
is he in cat prison yet?
I think there's days when he deserves it, because I think when Beck and I were recording a previous episode and he just casually came along and chomped her, which was because he wasn't getting enough attention. I was getting attention and on Zoom, and he wasn't. It's that thing that cats and scream. Yeah, we did. I think, did we keep that in? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
I can't remember.
No, I was just going to say, if we did have a Two Merlins podcast, it would be quite mundane, I'd imagine, for example. The most exciting thing that happened to Merlin this morning was the fact that the dustbin men and the street sweepers came along within half an hour of each other, and this was the best thing he'd ever seen.
Oh, very good. Well,
I think given that we've got Merlin's trying to climb on the back of a cow or the back of a sheep or whatever, I think there's potential. And of course, the weekly egg update.
Yeah, because there's one day, I just saw this white blur across the field. It was Merlin, because it's just Dad's white cat. And he was actually being followed by sheep, really, really angry sheep. And I was like, oh, fuck's sake. And then rather than coming in the house, he then kind of just hopped up on the shed and just looked over the fence at them. And they're all at the fence, banging against the fence. Oh, yeah, we had a cow ring the doorbell. Did I tell you? Oh, here he is. Merlin.
Merlin.
Oi. Come here, fluffy nuts. A cow actually broke through the fence, and because I can't hear the doorbell anymore, I've got this video doorbell, so it's connected to my phone. So my phone flashes to let me know there's something at the door. And it was a cow. It was a cow standing at the door. I'll send you the picture of this young calf that had broken through. Come here.
That's amazing.
Eventually, he turns up.
Aww.
Better late than never.
Yeah.
You okay, mate?
Oh, he's looking at us now, as if to say, what's going on? Who are these people? Oh, he even said, hello, 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 hello.
There we go.
He's a podcast professional.
He's a fluffy.
Cool.
Merlin, can we have your permission, please, so we can listen to each of the episodes in turn now. Episode 1, Look Lively London, was broadcast with Dead London on the 19th of October, 2008.
Someone's playing with us, manipulating time and space.
I'm so gonna kill the Doctor when I find him. It was meant to be the 21st century, not the pig in First World War.
I suspect we're dealing with something or someone rather nasty.
Keep away from me, you freak!
Take the Doctor and the girl to Newgate!
Why are you doing this?
Beyond the Vortex, Part 1. Look Lively, London.
Hello, my name's Nick Briggs, and I'm the executive producer of the Audio Adventures of Doctor Who. We were really pleased about how the first season of The Eighth Doctor and Lucy Adventures went, actually. We always had high hopes for it, but the teaming of Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith really seemed to, I don't know, it seemed to really spark, and the two of them got on very well, and the relationship worked.
How can you not like spaceships?
I do, just not in the sense that I want a poster of one on my bedroom ceiling. That said, at least these are proper spaceships.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with the TARDIS.
No.
Apart from all the things that are wrong with the TARDIS.
Admittedly.
It's not so much a spaceship as a shed.
A shed?
I mean, Paul's always been good, but Sheridan, she's a genius, you know? She's able to do that really clever thing, which is kind of be funny and dramatic almost exactly at the same time, you know? That's really smart. And it gives the stories a lightness, but also it doesn't rob them of any of their dramatic impact.
The course is locked in. We can't change it.
Ferret!
What?
If saying ferret causes spaceships to crash, then maybe saying it again, you know, undoes the effect.
Oh, good grief.
Mole! Otter! Beaver! Oh, God, what are those things called that pop out of holes?
I don't believe it. I'm trapped on board a spaceship about to crash into a minor planet. My companion is listing vermin.
Meerkat!
It's interesting choosing an actor or actress to play a continuing role because, of course, there are loads of good actors around and you end up seeing people who play it pretty well and you'd think, well, if this was just a one-off part, absolutely I'd give them the role. But for someone to be a returning character, you need that extra, it's that sort of, dare I say, X factor that makes you want to come back and hear more. You know, it makes you... There's something with what Sheridan does with Lucy that you want to invest emotions in her character. So you want to come back and hear what she's up to next.
Where do they keep the aspirin? I've got one hell of a morning after.
Yeah, that would be the after effects of the gas.
No kidding.
it is quite difficult to get windows when, you know, in both their schedules. But, you know, we start asking early. We leave a lot of leeway in there. It does, you know, I say we start early, but the time we get the two of them together, we are rather sort of chewing our fingernails and worrying whether the post-production will ever be finished in time. But, yeah, it's one of those showbiz chores. But we get it done and we're really pleased to get the two of them together.
I have to find the bloke I came with, the doctor.
Dead London isn't being recorded first this week, so what made you shift it forward to be the season opener?
Well, I think originally the first one was going to be the story that's now called Brave New Town.
We spent hours walking around the village and there is no road leading out.
Should there be?
Of course there should. Where is the next town?
We did kind of know that we were leaving it a bit in flux, because even though there's a sort of thread running through it, it wasn't definite that they should run in a particular order except for the last few.
Have you anything to say in your defence?
We eventually decided on Dead London because we thought it was quite fun that it starts with the Doctor and Lucy separated. So we wanted to create a need in the audience for them to want to hear the Doctor and Lucy get back together. So that was our thinking behind it. And also it was just such a sort of crazy out there story to start with. We thought that would be fun.
So, case dismissed.
And how did Pat Mills get involved? Because for people who don't know, Pat Mills is quite a renowned comic book author.
Yes, Pat Mills is a very renowned comic book author and has worked with Alan Barnes, our script editor, who was a former editor of the magazine, the Judge Dredd 2000 AD magazine. He also has a little bit of history with Doctor Who because he wrote some great Doctor Who comic strips when the Doctor Who Weekly, as it was then, it's now Doctor Who Magazine, but when that started, he wrote some of the best remembered stories, Tom Baker stories. He wrote Doctor Who writ large, you know, Doctor Who with an enormous budget because it was in a comic strip and it only took the skill of an artist to bring it to life. And that was, you know, in the before time, before Doctor Who could be spectacular and full of amazing CGI effects. Alan, as I say, had worked with him in the context of 2000 AD. And so based on that and his work on the Doctor Who comic strips and the fact that he did actually write a script for Doctor Who called The Space Whale, which never got made for, I don't know, it was sometime in the Colin Baker era, I believe. We knew he had a huge imagination, and Alan in particular really crusaded on Pat Mills' behalf. You know, he really felt that Pat could bring something exciting and totally outlandish to us. And there is a very different flavour to Pat's story, I feel.
That's outrageous.
And as ever, quite a great cast in this one. Rupert Van Sittart, Richard Lang. Richard Lang spent most of the recording being a bit confused.
Sorry, my lad.
A lot of people get very confused on Big Finish recordings, especially when they're playing lots of different characters. But Rupert Van Sittart, he'd been in the television episode Aliens of London and World War III. And he was just amazing. Such a lovely urbane character, you know, full of interesting stories and just a very forceful vocal presence. We liked him a lot.
Take the Doctor and the Girl to Newgate!
It's a bit like Rep recording some of these productions, isn't it? In this particular run, Katarina Olsen is in all of them, but playing a different role in each one.
Yellow Beryl, they call me.
Yeah, we do like that thing, because one of the strengths of radio drama is that it gives actors more freedom. You know, if they have vocal dexterity, they can play lots more characters than they would play on screen. And you're absolutely right. It is rather like doing a theatre rep thing, where it gives, and must, you know, being an actor, I'm in favour of anything that gives actors the chance to show their ample abilities.
Who wants Dip and Wallop for a bawby?
Dip and Wallop?
I think you've earned it by just simply asking Dip and Wallop.
Katarina Olsen is a case in point that she's a fantastic radio actress. She's great with the microphone. She really enjoys the process. You know, some actors are a bit scared of it. You can see they go into the booth and they look at the mic and they put the cans on, and there's a vibe about them that makes them appear to be like fishes out of water.
You're all right, love.
It's quite nice to have some relaxed, confident people around, because confidence and the sort of calmness that comes with that is catching. And these productions really live and die on the atmosphere in the studio. And, you know, luckily we always have a good, fun atmosphere.
Nick, can you have stinking fish, law how they do stink today?
Stinking fish, law how they do stink today. Stinking fish, law how they do stink today. Subtle acting, no chance.
I think it's great to employ people to come along and, you know, not just play a small part, but play several small parts, or a big part and a small part. I think it's, you know, it's much more fun for actors to be active and doing something rather than sitting in the green room and saying, well, that's my 15th cup of coffee today and I'm not going to sleep tonight.
Next time on Doctor Who.
I'm the Doctor, this is Lucy. We're investigators. We have reason to believe that young Timber was murdered.
That guy, he just crashed into a moon.
Yeah, looks like it.
There are those on both sides who have good reason to bear grudges.
What we saw was no accident. I can't help feeling we're missing something elementary.
Go, Sherlock. Go, Sherlock.
Could you not do that when I'm trying to concentrate?
How do we get out of this thing? Help! Help!
There is no way out.
Doctor Who. Max Warp.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Beyond the Vortex featured contributions from Nicholas Briggs. It was produced by Martin Montague.
Episode 2, Full Throttle, was released with Max Warp, first broadcast on the 26th of October, 2008.
I'm the Doctor, this is Lucy. We're investigators.
I'm having a bit of difficulty here, Chief.
We're investigating a murder.
Tith intended the spaceship to crash. They're trying to provoke us into war.
Request immediate dispatch of the Kith battle fleet.
We're at war.
Doctor?
Lucy, get out. Run!
Beyond the Vortex, Part 2. Full Throttle.
I'm Barnaby Edwards, and I am the director and casting director.
Hello, my name's Nick Briggs, and I'm the executive producer of the audio adventures of Doctor Who.
We're going to have to give you some more bits, Sammy, otherwise it's not clear that it's you being grabbed. So I think when he says, now you leave me no choice but to, oh, Gilbride, do something. I think we need to, oh. Yes, Gilbride,
oh, right.
Do something.
Oh, Gilbride!
And then right at the end of the scene, this way, Madam President, we need a sort of, as you're being taken out. Very good. Those exact semitones, please.
This is a fantastic one. This is the first one of the scripts to sort of be proposed, and the first one that we read, and we just thought, oh, that sounds so perfect, so good, because it's a really brilliant story. It is basically Top Gear in space with some murders.
Were yes. there any discussions about how close to a Top Gear parody you wanted to get?
Do you have any idea how tedious it is to talk about spaceships all the time?
There was a little bit of discussion, and I think that in the original version of the script, that Johnny Morris, the writer, some of the parody aspects of it were just so, to coin a phrase, on the nose, that it was just so obvious that it kind of distracted from the drama of it, and so he adjusted that. And I think what you've got now is something that's clearly got that flavour of Top Gear.
Whatever happens, no matter what, I get the last word, OK?
I don't know, putting that together with an Agatha Christie-style murder mystery just seems to... It's a totally bizarre and unexpected fusion, and I think it works really well.
This is my show. I refuse to be upstaged by a girl.
I think it's always a good idea to tap into something that audiences are familiar with, and Top Gear is one of those programmes that has... You know, I'm not very interested in cars, frankly. I drive one out of necessity and would rather not. I'd rather have a hover chair. But I will watch Top Gear because of the characters involved. So, very sensibly, Johnny made it about the characters. And, you know, they're not exact replicas, but there are similarities, I feel.
Very entertaining, but you can't prove any of this.
It instantly appealed to all of us, and we just thought this is a great one for Sheridan, the Sheridan and Paul combination. And it offered vastly superior opportunities for casting.
This show is watched by blokes throughout the seven galaxies. The last thing we need is to broaden our appeal, particularly with a female of the weaker gender.
I'm the world's biggest Goodies fan, and I have now worked with all three Goodies. You know, not for the last time, I'm telling you, I love them all. I absolutely love the Goodies. And I was in one that Graham Garden was in. I was acting in one that Graham Garden was in. that he did for us before in Big Finish. And he was so charming and lovely and nice. And he's exactly how you hear him on I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue and things like that. He's just a lovely, lovely man.
He's got you there, Chief.
Shut up, O'Reilly.
Because he's such a perceptive writer himself and a great satirist, and a lot of send-up in the goodies, and since then he's constantly, you know, doing radio or television programmes, which are satire. He's got such a clear ear and an eye for the inanities that television presenters can do.
There are spaceships, and there are spaceships. And then there are spaceships.
And, you know, it was a great script, and a lot of it was sort of on a plate for him there, but he managed to sort of lift it and take it to sort of stratospheric heights.
Altitude 800 miles, 600. Tell me, Jeff.
And, of course, there was the very risque sort of joke in it that one of the presenters was, you know, died horribly in an accident, which of course didn't happen to Richard Hammond, you know, and as it turns out, well, I shall say no more, unless you've already heard it.
So let me get this straight. I murdered Timbo, except I didn't.
Since you've already heard it, yeah, you know, it turns out that pretty much like Richard Hammond, he didn't die at all. But unlike Richard Hammond, he's been hiding inside a robot suit. I don't think Richard Hammond did that, did he?
Well, we never know.
But that's probably in the next series of Top Gear.
Next time on Doctor Who.
Where is the next town? In fact, where is this town?
Thorrington in Suffolk.
The whole sea just disappeared.
The sea was here yesterday.
And that would be Sunday, the 1st of September, 1991.
Yeah, of course.
Like today.
Let me put this into perspective, Lucy Miller. You're in a restricted area.
You can pull that gun down. There's no need to...
Someone's shooting!
Doctor Who, Brave New Town.
Contact is restored.
Beyond the Vortex featured contributions from Nicholas Briggs and Barnaby Edwards. It was produced by Martin Montague.
Sherbet Fountain!
Only if you could.
Episode 3, Every Day is Like Sunday, goes behind the scenes of Brave New Town and was first broadcast on the 2nd of November, 2008.
The sea was here yesterday.
Yesterday? And that would be Sunday, the 1st of September, 1991, yes?
Yeah, of course.
Like today.
Every day is like Sunday.
Contact is restored.
What does it all mean, Doctor?
It means that these aren't like any Autons I've ever met before.
Can we take them out with explosives?
Can't kill them, they're innocent.
Blow up the cliff!
Here goes. Brace yourself, yes?
Beyond the Vortex, Part 3. Every day is like Sunday.
Well, I'm Barnaby Edwards, and I am the casting director.
Hello, my name's Nick Briggs, and I'm the executive producer of the audio adventures of Doctor Who.
Search your heart, search your soul.
It was originally called The Plastic Population, but we rather thought the title gave it away. Because Autons are plastic, and it would have taken Doctor Who fans about 3 seconds to work that out.
They're almost independent. Autonomic Autons.
Now, the Autons, they don't immediately stand out as being an audio-friendly monster, do they? So I guess a lot of work had to be done in presenting the Autons differently.
Well, yes, this was something that Alan Barnes was particularly keen on. And he said, that very thing, that Autons are not audio-friendly. They don't really speak. They just walk around and their hands go, and then they shoot people, you know. I do all the sound effects. So, yeah, how can you do that on audio? Well, what you do is what doesn't usually happen with a returning monster. Because in essence, returning monster stories are quite often a complete retelling of the original story, you know, just dressed up in slightly different clothes. It's usually the same beats. So he wanted Alan wanted the writer Jonathan Clements to do something completely different and have this the possibility of some Autons getting their own free will and not really understanding that they were Autons. And so suddenly, rather than it being a returning monster story, it becomes more to do with the crisis of identity and what makes you a living being. And you know, are you any less valid if you don't understand the very nature of what you are? You know, so I mean, because most of the Auton characters in Brave New Town are quite sympathetic characters. You know, there's the dad and the girl and the policeman, and you know, and they're really quite affable and nice. And I think that's the only way, that's the best way to bring monsters back. And also, considering it was audio, you know, we had to find a new and exciting take on it. And I think that's what Jonathan did.
You can't tell me it's not worth dying for.
And there's a bit of a joke in there, isn't there, about Bryan Adams, that particular record, appearing to be at number one forever.
Well, there's another quid for the bet we had on that song.
Oh, it's not still number one.
It certainly is.
Well, this came from Jonathan Clemens having... it's an experience he had somewhere. I don't know whether it was at a wedding reception or something, where it was just constantly being played. And I think it was just a bit of emotional memory from him that he just wanted to get in that dig.
According to Baz, it's set to break the record for most weeks at number one. Look into your
heart. Another good cast in this one. Paul McGann teamed up with Adrian Dunbar, and they were at drama school together, weren't they?
I believe so, yes. And... yeah, and had a lot of laughs. Yes, they worked. There was a lot of hilarity going on in the studio because they were old mates,
like a couple of naughty school kids getting.
Yes,
together.
There was. Yes, naughty schoolboyism going on.
Don't let the doctor out of your sight.
And Adrian's another actor I've been desperately trying to get for ages because he's got a very particular style. What I like very much about Adrian is that he is. He's got a slight edge to him that you don't quite trust what he does, and you're never quite sure whether he's suddenly going to, you know, lunge and stab you in the chest, or just shake your hand and say, "Oh, I'm saving you from you know, a falling piece of masonry or something." He's very, very unpredictable as an actor, and that's an incredibly useful trait. And we've been trying to think of the right role for him. I think we did. There's a role last year in last year's McGann season where we were very. He was on the sort of one of him or another actor we were contemplating, but Adrian was absolutely the right actor for this because it's a very sort of enigmatic character, and you know, Adrian does it very well. There's lots of bits where you think, oh, I quite like this character, and then he says, shoot them, you know, if you see them, shoot them. And you think, God, he's, you know, he's a real swine.
I don't care if it's the Women's Institute coming over that hill. If they're armed and dangerous, I'm blowing them up.
So it's very, very nice that he said yes. And the reason he said yes was entirely because of Paul McGann. He worked with Paul before. Because you never really know. I mean, you offer an actor a role, and it's very rarely going to be the money. It's most often going to be the script. But sometimes the one deciding factor may be that there's another member of the cast that they really like and they haven't seen for years.
Don't tell me it's not worth fighting for.
I had a go at her because she was singing that wretched song.
What song?
Bryan Adams. You know, everything he does it for you, number one.
A wedding classic.
I've been desperately trying to get Derek Griffiths into one of these because he's, you know, a lot of people, sort of my generation, will remember Derek from television, children's television programs. Sort of grew up hearing his voice, and he would, you know, tell stories and do Jack and Nori and various different things. But actually, you know, and in my head, I sort of thought, I wonder what Derek's done since then. But Derek has probably not had a week off. For the last 40 years, he's constantly in employment. You know, he's doing Miss Saigon, or he's doing some other theatre things, or some more television or films or voiceovers, and he is so versatile and so brilliant.
He is Mr. Voiceover. We're very lucky to get him because he does so much voice work all around the world. He does stuff in foreign languages, he does children and old ladies' voices. You know, he's incredible, really. And it was lovely to get him along, you know, to play sort of Mr. Normal Bloke, and he did it. I think he did it to perfection. It's quite funny that he actually expected to be playing the Daleks because he thought, oh, it's Doctor Who, the Daleks must be in it. So he was practicing on his way to the studio. Well, I did tell him that he couldn't do the voice of the Daleks because I was the voice of the Daleks, which he was quite shocked about. He went, oh, are you? Oh, you know, worried he'd trodden on my toes, vocally speaking.
Exterminate!
Next time on Doctor Who.
Light and darkness burning in one.
Lead us not into perfection, for never and ever.
Would you help us, Doctor?
If you tell me everything,
I stand before the skull
and invoke the rules of war.
There'll be no fighting in this sanctuary.
Bring the doctor. The skull chooses him.
Have you told the rest of your order who it is who's killing them?
Doctor, let him go!
Lucille!
Doctor!
Who's there? Who wants me?
What is it? Show me.
They're here.
The gates!
The sanctuary. Sanctuary, that's the last thing it is.
Doctor Who, The Skull of Sobek.
The final battle approaches.
Doctor!
Beyond the Vortex featured contributions from Nicholas Briggs and Barnaby Edwards. It was produced by Martin Montague.
Everything I do.
I'm sick of that bleeding tune.
I do it for you.
Now!
Episode 4, Rock Around the Croc, accompanied The Skull of Sobek and was first broadcast on the 9th of November 2008.
This is muttering before a sermon and then we hush as the sermon is announced. And remember your sweet, nice, non-swearing nuns and brethren. Okay?
Yes.
And
today's revelation is taken from the Triumphs of Sobek, the final chapter, the burning of the world.
These are teeth marks, large, predatory, possibly reptilian. Any crocodiles around here?
Crocodiles?
There's something in here.
Under the water, it's big.
What's that?
Behind you, get out!
Doctor!
Who's there?
The Skull of Sobek shall remember this day.
Beyond the Vortex, Part 4. Rock Around the Croc.
Hello, my name's Nick Briggs, and I'm the executive producer of the Audio Adventures of Doctor Who. When you're commissioning different stories, when you get to know your writers, you get a feel for what you're going to get from them. So, you know, if we decide to commission Mark Platt to do something, normally in the schedule it says, like, something weird.
A bit blue, innit?
It's the blue desert, Lucy. It's what Indigo 3 is famous for.
And we thought, yeah, on another planet maybe, you know. And then you speak to Mark and say, what have you got? And he says, oh, and he said, crocodiles. We've got to do big monster crocodiles. And Alan Barnes said, that's Doctor Who. Yes, we're doing that.
Sister Lucy.
It's all right, I'm just leaving.
No, come down, Lucy.
What big teeth you have. You won't eat me or anything.
Come down to us.
It initially started off as a sort of strange road movie thing set on futuristic Earth, and which, of course, clashed massively with the TV episode Gridlock. And so we were asked not to do something set in flying cars going around a futuristic city.
Because it's worth pointing out at this point that you have to run all your scripts past the BBC in Cardiff to
well,
make sure
indeed,
there's no clash.
Because, you know, the Doctor Who brand is one big thing and, you know, we have a very close and fruitful relationship with Cardiff and, you know, discussions go on about stories. So it's all very friendly and, you know, there are no sort of draconian measures taken.
You bit off my hand!
So we run stuff past them when we've got ideas and they go, oh, yeah, 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 oh, we'll steer clear from away from that, because just in case. Of course, we do get the funny thing where sometimes we're steering clear of ideas that end up not being in the Doctor Who series, you know. But, you know, that's the way things go. I mean, the you know production is and scripts and ideas are very fluid, of course, in a creative environment, yes. Get me back to the point.
Tell them about the skull.
Oh, Skull of Sobek.
And from the waters rose the great skull of Sobek the god, and its thoughts were amongst them.
Venomous, controlling thoughts.
And the skull was 300 cubits long and 30 cubits high. You'd think we might notice something as big as that.
That is definitely big. What a monster.
So Mark altered it and set it on this blue planet and just did this really crazy stuff, really. It feels, I don't know, it's set in this sort of monastery thing. It's got a kind of Alien 3 vibe going on. And, the, you know, and then we got the most amazing cast, you know, people playing and Sean Bickerstaff playing, you know, a crocodile.
And talking like this the whole time.
It's great.
Who is the stranger? Who is he?
The
the Doctor?
The final battle approaches. Bring him to us.
The thing that Mark Platt is really good at is creating a totally crazy, unrelated to reality world and making it really believable and setting up its own really weird rules. It's a bit like the old writer from the old series of Doctor Who, Robert Holmes, where he'd just make little remarks in the script. The characters make little remarks that would somehow hint at a whole backstory, you know, some war that had taken place or something like that. And you suddenly believe this whole history of, you know, this crocodile struggle between two royal houses, which has been going on, and which is what the story is essentially about.
Page 63, a booming voice from inside the skull. It's just a booming voice.
Right, so it's not meant to be a crocodile.
It is an old ancient crocodile.
Right, so just three times Sobek.
Yeah, bigger
each time.
Okay.
Sobek. 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 Where's the toilet?
Next time on Doctor Who.
Oh, look. What? There's the Doctor and Lucy. Blimey, Charlotte!
What was that? I don't know. Where's the diamond?
The black diamond?
That's what he said.
I have reason to believe that the diamond is dangerous.
Oh? What reason?
Merely the fact that it's the work of Claudio Tardelli.
Doctor, behind you!
Good grief, the statue, it's moving!
Doctor Who, Grand Theft Cosmos.
We're going to steal it first.
Beyond the Vortex featured contributions from Nicholas Briggs. It was produced by Martin Montague.
The fifth episode, Cosmic Capers, went out after Grand Theft Cosmos on the 16th of November, 2008.
They're on the train. The Doctor and the Geezer from the museum.
The Doctor?
Yes, with a certain crushing inevitability it is.
Good heavens, the statue!
What the heck? It's pushing its way through the room!
I have reason to believe that the diamond is dangerous.
Oh? What reason?
My name is Claudio Tardelli.
His works alter the fabric of the world around them.
Beyond the Vortex, Part 5. Cosmic Capers.
Whatever.
Well, I'm Barnaby Edwards, and I am the director and casting director.
Hello, my name's Nick Briggs, and I'm the executive producer of the audio adventures of Doctor Who.
There! Why didn't you do that earlier?
It's a brilliant story by Eddie Robson. It's a big Ocean's 11 heist story. A diamond is stolen, and we wanted to bring back two of the most popular characters from the last BBC 7 series, the Headhunter.
I've told you, Karen, I don't do apologies.
And Karen.
Next time we rob a train, we do it sometime after the invention of the motorbike. I'm not cut out for all this Butch Cassidy stuff.
And we just thought they're such good characters, we can't not bring them back. They're such a funny team, and the idea that they would then be working together, they are chalk and cheese.
Good grief, you throw like a girl!
Sorry!
Obviously, logistically, it's quite hard to find a date when, you know, both of them are free and Paul's free. And Sheridan would have been free, but she sadly had some dates moved around. But it's brilliant to bring them back, because, you know, Katerina is fantastic as the Headhunter and had such a great sort of reaction from listeners. And so did Louise as Karen. So when we come into the story, they've been sort of, you know, working partnership for some time when we come in, and they've got already a little sort of patter between them. And Eddie Robson has done some fantastic things, making them almost like a corollary to the Doctor and Lucy, this other team of time-travelling people who are only in it for the money.
He's got me!
Throw me the diamond!
You'll help me afterwards, right?
Yes.
All right, then. Catch!
He's done the meeting of them again really brilliantly, you know, when Lucy bumps into them in the train and says, "I thought you were dead." "Oh, no, it's fine." "Oh, all right, yeah, maybe I misheard." "Yes, you must have misheard." "Oh, I see, right, yeah. I must have accidentally misheard, you know, that you were alive and well in 1890s Sweden as I'm dead." It's brilliant to have them back, and they are such fun in the studio as well.
Oh, look over there. What?
Oh, I can't believe I fell for that.
Stop her!
But it could so easily have just been a story about the Headhunter and Karen again. But Eddie Robson's written a really good sort of different type of story, jewel theft, sort of first great train robbery kind of a story. And you know, there are a number of really good new characters, and Simonson, the Michael Maloney part, is one of those. And he's such a sort of important, slightly comical, slightly serious, sympathetic. He gets to ride in the TARDIS, a whole number of things. And you really need a really good actor for that, because he's got to hold quite a lot of the heart of the story, while a lot of, you know, beautiful Eddie Robson comedy is going on in the background. And so I'm pleased that Michael Maloney's come to do that.
I'm quite accustomed to it.
Thank you. He's a brilliant character actor. I'd sort of like to become one of those actors who works all the time, and every time people see you in something, think, that's brilliant. This is what they always think about Michael Maloney. And he has got a superb voice. I mean, I know, you know, BBC use him all the time for voiceovers and radio work. Yeah, I'm so pleased that he's come to play this, because it's quite a tricky part. I wanted someone who could do without being remotely caricatured, who could do slightly precise, slightly almost prissy kind of art collector. Michael Maloney is a fiercely intelligent person, and you know, he can do that kind of thing perfectly. And I just thought that would be really nice to have. I could imagine his vocal quality opposite Paul McGann's.
Excellent. If we withdraw to the palace, I shall discuss a price with you.
Grand Theft Cosmos is a story where Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith weren't both available on the same day. So how did you handle that?
The schedule for the recording worked out that we knew that there was one story where we wouldn't be able to get the two of them together. I'm not quite certain now why we picked Grand Theft Cosmos. I think it's largely to do with the fact that Barnaby Edwards, who's the series producer on this particular strand of stories for us, he does all the planning, all the difficult stuff, all the writing of lists. He worked out that Lucy was kind of on her own away from the Doctor a lot more in that story than in others.
This is not an uncommon thing.
Really?
Quite often we have the companion who can't make the same recording date as the Doctor, because, you know, in a sense, it's easier to assemble the guest cast for a day, but the essentials, because you can always, if an actor can't make it as part of the guest cast, then you'll just recast it, because it's only for one-off story. But obviously, a companion and a doctor have to be free on the same day, and with people as busy as Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith, that cannot, that's very, very hard to arrange. So this is the first time that we've done it with Sheridan, but she's a very experienced radio actor. And Paul is a very experienced radio actor, and yeah, they'll cope very well. So Paul is going to be with the main cast, and we're getting Katarina Olsen to read in Sheridan's lines for that. And then before that, we've recorded Sheridan on her own with Nick Briggs reading in all the Doctor's lines. And then we'll piece it together, and I'm really sure that people won't notice the difference.
Because it's important, isn't it, that they have got someone to react against rather than them just reading out a set of lines?
Yes. I mean, they could do it just reading out a set of lines, but I think for pacing terms, it's also useful for me as a director to make sure that I make the pace of both scenes the same, and that's harder for me if people are just reading out individual lines. So if I bounce, you know, one actor, substitute actor against the real one, then it's a lot easier for me to sort of pick the pace up. You know, Sheridan could do it just reading our lines. We had recently Bonnie Langford doing that. And, you know, Bonnie does practically 5 radio plays a week, so it was no problem to her at all, and it won't be a problem to Sheridan. It's an unusual situation, but not that uncommon.
I don't think this is the real thing.
Sheridan has become like a commodity. She was biked over to us. She was doing television during the day, and she had theatre in the evening. She was doing Little Shop of Horrors. I'm not quite sure what the television thing was. And she had a gap in her schedule of, I think, just over an hour. So she had to be biked to us, you know, a big hairy biker with leathers and a little microphone in his helmet. And the two of them used to speak as they you know, rode along the road, the highways of London.
Lucy?
Yeah, it's me. They're bringing the TARDIS down now.
And she's biked over to us. She came in and she spent just over 45 minutes in a booth with me reading all the other parts, doing all the funny character voices. And she did the whole thing almost straight off. I mean, she gave us lots of alternative takes as well.
Lucy?
I'm knackered. I want to go to bed.
Next time on Doctor Who.
We're here for the poetry, the scenery,
and Auntie Pat.
I never knew you were happy and successful in 1984. What's that supposed to mean?
That I'm not happy or successful in the future.
I've done that again, haven't I?
They've lost their own homeworld, you see. They've tried to steal the Earth before. Looks like they're at it again.
Who?
They're called the Zygons.
Phase 5 of the Zygon Gambit is to detonate the gases in the atmosphere.
Ow! Look, I didn't see anything.
Doctor Who, the Zygon who fell to Earth.
We cannot let you go.
No!
Beyond the Vortex featured contributions from Nicholas Briggs and Barnaby Edwards. It was produced by Martin Montague and Kerry McCarthy.
Whatever.
The sixth and final episode, Trether of the Zygons, was named after the story's working title and first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2008, Doctor Who's 45th birthday.
We're here with the poetry, the scenery, and Auntie Pat.
Get your mitts off my necklace!
Your necklace? It belongs to the Zygons. It's part of us and our future plans.
Let me go! It's part of me now!
Very well, if you won't relinquish it, I must take you with me.
Trevor!
Beyond the Vortex, Part 6. Trevor of the Zygons.
But that means Patricia.
And one more bit more impassioned and running.
But that means Patricia.
Not, thank you.
Hello, my name's Nick Briggs, and I'm the executive producer of the Audio Adventures of Doctor Who.
Then we're moving on to Dr. Lucy, Trevor, Ertak, Mims and Pat, scene 21.
Is Trevor voice affected or not?
I don't think so, but we'll come to that. I'm fairly sure he doesn't revert yet. No, he doesn't. But the death scene is human.
Now, The Zygon Who Fell to Earth, for kind of sci-fi fans, you've got in it Stephen Pacey, who people may remember as Tarrant in Blake 7. He's got quite a recognisable voice, but in this he's got a marmoset accent.
That's right. That was his decision in conjunction with Barnaby Edwards, who was directing it. And they thought, because he had this, his character had this history as a folk singer, Stephen thought it might be fun. I mean, obviously, he was hedging his bets because he wants to come back and do something else.
I'm quite happy here with my new life as a hotelier, away from showbiz.
But he's another of these actors, like I was saying about Katarina Olsen, who is totally at home with the microphone. He does loads of talking books. He does a lot for BBC Audio as well. And he's just brilliant at it, you know, and a joy to have around. And, of course, he had to sing a song in it as well. Two versions of the same song, you know, the original 60s version of Falling Star and the ghastly 80s electro-pop remix, which I secretly loved.
You're all alone and your life's far from home.
You know, I really prefer the remix. It's commercial. You can dance to it.
It's also most annoying.
Was that part of the casting, that you had to get someone in that role who could sing, or
yes,
were you prepared to use a singer as well?
No. Barney, I mean, it's also a monetary concern, but Barney, you know, really wanted someone who could play the part well and sing. And of course, Stephen Pacey is well known for having done lots of musical roles as well as being a very good actor.
And this one you have Tim Brooke Taylor playing as Zygon.
Now, I hope that you will do your best to seem normal.
Of course, Second-in-Command Ertak.
And don't call me that!
One of the Zygons was written as a bit of a comedy sidekick. And again, you see, like the Auton story, this was like a new way of bringing a monster back, not doing the typical thing.
We are going to work on you, Trevor.
Mims.
Sorry.
So, yeah, Tim Brooke Taylor playing this rather strange Zygon sidekick who kind of was being influenced by the sort of feelings that the human being he had transformed himself to look like would experience. So there's all this business about sharing a double room with his boss. You know, and he keeps saying, no, we wouldn't mind a double room. A double room would be fine.
How would you do that for?
Forgive Mims. He gets overexcited sometimes.
Paul Maar's scripts, they do tend to be quite left field, don't they?
He's not a great fan of logic, Paul. and this is something he'd say as well. You know, that sounds like I'm having a go at him, but I'm not. You know, he does. It's all weird and wonderful and magical with Paul. So we do have to try and keep him on the straight and narrow. But it does mean that he will always come up with rather beautiful ideas, you know, that are not constrained by, well, by being too sensible, frankly.
What the hell was that?
A giant sea monster.
Of course.
In terms of the plotting, it starts off fairly light, but by the end there's quite a bit of a dark turnaround, especially in the Dr. Lucy relationship, given yes. what he's done.
Yes, well, I like that very much, because actually for my tastes the story was too light to start with, and you know, I have so many responsibilities at Big Finish doing all the audio adventures that, you know, I have to make decisions to what degree I will be involved with certain stories, and I have to delegate responsibilities. And so, you know, that story was that was very much delegated to Alan and Barnaby. I was aware of the storyline and I'd briefly looked over the script, but I had to leave that with them to concentrate on other things, writing scripts, for example. You know, and you have to do this when, you know, because we're doing 13 in the main range and these 8 and a whole load of other things every year. So it's not like just doing 13 TV scripts. It's a bit different, you know. So I have a lot to think about. So I had to let this one go. So I have to admit that when I heard the initial edit of it, I was, as I started to listen to it, I was quite unhappy with the levity of the beginning of the story.
He is a Zygon.
So I dated far worse when I was your age.
And I thought, oh, this is a shame, because, you know, the Zygons are a great monster. I thought, let's not fritter them away on something silly. But the resolution of the story, I think, is so dark. And I love that. I love that it, you know, it goes that way. I think that's just right.
So we're going for a take on this?
Will you bring him here?
Nims will take the captives to the cells.
You can at least let me see him.
Your part in this affair is almost over.
Lovely.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Beyond the Vortex featured contributions from Nicholas Briggs. It was produced by Martin Montague and Kerry McCarthy.
Martin, thanks once again for joining us. It's very much appreciated, as ever.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh,
as it were.
I'm so sorry. Because I've got you in the corner of my screen, it went from Kenny's face to this cat just rubbing against your chin. That is the cutest thing. Oh, no. So where can people follow you on social media to keep up to date with you? And, of course...
Yeah, it's Merlin they're interested in, not me. Yeah, Twitter, and my hashtag, my get off that. My handle is, you know, I've never actually read it out before, and it was sheer desperation. Oh yeah, it's Twitter is @MartinM_media.
Brilliant.
What?
Fantastic. And Martin, I have to say, those episode titles are wonderful. I particularly liked Every Day Is Like Sunday and Rock Around the Crock, but as you know, do like a good pun.
I'd forgotten about those. It was, I mean, that was real kind of last minute thing of, you know, let's get, oh God, I don't know. So yeah, it was good fun.
Brilliant. So of course, listeners, if you've enjoyed this week's episode of Pieces of Eighth, or indeed any episode we've done, you can leave us a review on iTunes, as it means more people can find our episodes. And it's always appreciated. Somebody actually scored us an 8 out of 5. So thank you, whoever you were.
I love that. That is fantastic.
Oh, very
well,
good.
Kenny, where is our lovely TV movie TARDIS taking us for next week's episode?
Well, next week, we're actually going to encounter, at long last, the final part of the Mary Shelley trilogy as we go behind the scenes of Army of Death. And we've actually got a very rare and exclusive interview, as Alan Barnes, who was a script editor, doesn't really do that many interviews. And he very kindly had a quick chat with me the other day when we were chatting for Vortex. And he gave me a few minutes to chat about the Mary Shelley trilogy as a whole, and in particular, Army of Death. So that's kind of cool.
That is very cool.
And it's going to be the penultimate episode of this season that started off as 13 episodes, and this is number 27. So...
Wow.
There we go.
That's a terrifying amount of time recording, Kenny.
I know. But yes, we'll be back then. So until then, I've been Kenny Smith, and I still am him.
And I was, and still am, Rebecca Chapman. Martin, would you like to say goodbye too?
Yes, yeah, I am, and was, and sometimes continue to be Martin Montague.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I don't know what I was waving at.
Sorry, it's automatic.